Greetings, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of H2O Talk, the podcast that's all about water, environment, and society as it's related. I'm your host, Tom Bellinger. I appreciate you joining us. And today we're going to focus on what they call forever chemicals. A bit of a, no pun intended, persistent problem in the environment. It's all throughout the environment. And we will start off with a little water news. If you would like to contact me, remember our email is h2otalkpodcast@aol.com. So first, let's start off with a little water news. And this is out of Science Daily. And the headline is, expanding large-scale agriculture is escalating flooding in the largest South American breadbasket. And this basically came out of Lancaster University. A summary of the article basically is we're looking at soaring international demand. Due to that, extensive areas of grasslands and forests across South American plains have rapidly been converted to the production of annual crops, such as soybean and maize. So essentially what they're doing is they are taking a lot of these natural grasslands, natural forests out, converting it to agricultural land, and that's a major change in land use, and that can affect a lot of things such as drainage. So this agricultural expansion has been taking place at a very high rate, 2.1 million hectares a year. So that's about 1 million acres a year. A new study shows how these shifts in annual crop agriculture, which relies on rainfall rather than irrigation, is also rapidly disrupting the water table across large flat regions of the Pampas and the Chaco Plains and contributing to significantly increased risk of surface flooding. So essentially, if we take a lot of the natural vegetation out of an area, we can change drainage patterns, we can change how that vegetation once maybe absorbed flows or slowed down flows. So potentially you can have more flooding. You could, depending on what they're doing, maybe have a little more erosion. It might change the ability of water to penetrate the soil and get into the groundwater table. So again, land use, and maybe land use that's not well thought out, can affect a lot of our natural water resources in a region, such as in South America, especially when you're removing so many acres of this natural vegetation a year. So this is something that we have to deal with any kind of development, building a city, building farms, building suburbs. We change drainage patterns, etc. So this is really a big, significant change in this area. And it could also affect the ability to store carbon. And that can tie into climate change. In another story, and this comes out of McGill University, is about the Labrador Current. So changes to the flow of the Labrador Current along the coast of Newfoundland and Labrador to Nova Scotia are leading to sudden warmings or drops in the oxygen levels of waters in several regions, including the St. Lawrence Gulf and the St. Lawrence Estuary. This change has consequences for marine ecosystems and fisheries, which are not all that good. To better predict what could happen in the future, researchers have set out to answer the question, what controls the pathway of the Labrador Current? So there are people that do research ocean currents, and understanding the changes in some of these currents is important to changes in weather, changes in transport of nutrients, possibly changes in migration patterns of fish, etc. For example, the North Atlantic Current, which originates in the Gulf of Mexico and flows up towards Iceland. That's another one that we tend to worry about. If that current tends to speed up or slow down, we can affect the weather in Northern Europe, possibly affect what types of storms hit the east coast of Canada and the US, etc. So there's a lot we don't know, and modeling does help in this area. And now what they're trying to do is trying to better understand the Labrador Current, because it does supply cold and oxygen-rich waters. If that changes, that could mean dire consequences for the fisheries in those areas. And finally, a news story. I was up in the Pacific Northwest, and they were talking about forever chemicals being found in the water, and we'll get much more into depth on this the rest of this podcast. But not too far from where I was, there is a trailer park area that's experiencing very high levels of these forever chemicals. And of course, this area of the Pacific Northwest, just west of Seattle, maybe to the south and west of Seattle, there's a lot of military bases which can be an originator of these forever chemicals, or PFAS. And they are getting into different water supplies, small communities that might be dependent on wells or might depend on local streams that might be carrying this material are being affected, and people are actually drinking bottled water. It's something that we still are learning how to treat for. And I thought I would just throw this little article out there because it does give us a good segue into our main topic of today, which is forever chemicals. So this isn't the only community affected by this. They're all over the country, and we'll get a little more into that. So let's talk about our main subject, the forever chemicals, or PFAS, P-F-A-S. The EPA, I would say, is a good website to go to. You can just Google PFAS, but there's various types of these chemicals. There's PFOA, PFOA, there's PFOS, PFOS, and PFAS. And these all tend to make up this general problem. So the EPA, of course, has been studying this along with different universities, etc. And the EPA is committed to providing more understandable and actionable information on these polyfluoroalkali substances, which are also known as PFAS, P-F-A-S, or forever chemicals, trying to get the word out to the American public. This has been in the news a fair amount lately, so I thought I would touch on this. So the EPA does have a website, and they do explain this. They also have an interactive map, which you can go to and look in your area and get some general ideas of the types of PFAS that might be in an area where you live. Now, plus 98% of the people in the world have some level of PFAS in their body. They're everywhere. Basically, coming from old military bases, coming from things like resistant materials like in Teflon cookware, things like that. Even surgical masks and gowns use these chemicals, which makes me wonder about what our health workers are exposed to on a day-to-day basis. But they're very widely used, they're very long-lasting chemicals, and they break down very slowly over time. So they don't degrade very quickly, which means that they kind of stick around forever. So hence the name forever chemicals. So because of their widespread use and their persistence, many PFAS are found in the blood of people and animals all over the world. And like I say, 98-99% of us probably, you know, essentially everybody probably has some level in them. And they're present in low levels in a variety of food products and in the environment, fish, etc. So they're found in water. They're found in the air. They're found in fish and soil at locations across the globe. So this means that we're surrounded by them and exposed to them quite a bit. Scientific studies have shown that the exposure of some PFAS in the environment may be linked to harmful health effects in humans and animals. And I think the jury's not quite out as far as exactly what these might cause, but I believe it's a variety of different cancers and et cetera, other health problems. So there are thousands of these PFAS chemicals, and they're found in many different consumer, commercial, and industrial products. Now, we're beginning to change this a little bit. For example, if you bought stick-resistant cookware like Teflon, that has a lot of these PFAS in them. Now we're going to some other types of materials that we can use to maybe protect us or keep us away from it. And hopefully those are safe, because these have been around for years and years and years, and we essentially didn't know anything about their effects, or at least it was not really made public. So it makes it very challenging to study and assess what our human health and environmental risks are. You know, if you ever to take a case to court, the burden of proof is on you to say that PFAS caused, say, your cancer. And out there in the legal world, that's an uphill battle, because you're exposed to other things. You're exposed to other chemicals. You're exposed to volatile organic compounds that you might be breathing in. You're exposed to a variety of different things that might be in your food supply. Fire retardants, plastics, like in carpeting in your automobile, things like that. So we are exposed to a lot of different things. And what's causing the problem? This is the difficulty of trying to untangle that mess. So we don't fully understand PFAS. And essentially, a lot of the researchers are trying to answer various questions. One of them is how to better and more efficiently detect and measure the PFAS in air, water, soil, and in fish and wildlife, critters that we eat on a daily basis. We don't know exactly how many people are exposed to PFAS, but we're getting a better idea all the time. What's our risk? And how harmful they are to people in the environment, as I just mentioned before, that's a question. Can they trigger certain types of diseases or cancers? For example, is there a synergy between the PFAS and other chemicals that are out there that might cause some of the issues, health issues that are out there? How do we treat drinking water? How to remove them from drinking water? So we're getting better with that. But again, that can be a very expensive situation. I mentioned in that story about that small community in the Pacific Northwest. They were estimating, in order to treat and bring them down to at least a decent level for a small area like a trailer park, it was going to cost $250,000 to maybe put in a system to do that. Imagine if you are trying to solve this issue at a municipality like Chicago, Denver, New York, whatever. That's a huge expense. And there's other things that we still have to treat for besides that. So anyway, we have a lot of state, local, tribal partners that work on this. We also have universities trying to figure out how we can learn more about these forever chemicals. So let's talk a little bit about some of the sources of these forever chemicals. They can be, as I mentioned before, in our drinking water, public drinking water systems, private wells, so groundwater. I mentioned they can be in soil and water near waste sites, maybe near an old military base, old factories, etc., or current operating military bases. So I was just, as I mentioned, in the Pacific Northwest. There's a lot of military bases in that area. You have the Bangor, Bremerton, the sub bases. You have a naval air station on Whidbey Island, and a variety of mothballed ships are up there. So there's a lot of that there. Airports. So one of the things is fire extinguishing foam that we use for fighting fires. So a lot of our people in the firefighting industry or profession can be exposed to these quite a bit. So especially with the foams that are used, for example, like at an airport, they're used for training and, of course, emergency response when needed at airports, shipyards, military bases, firefighting training facilities, chemical plants, refineries. So it's not just fighting the fires, it's training to fight the fires. PFAS can be in manufacturing or chemical production facilities. that produce or use these in their process. What about food? Fish caught from water contaminated by PFAS, dairy products from livestock that might be exposed to these chemicals. Those are what we would call pathways or vectors that can get into our bodies. Food packaging, for example, in grease-resistant paper, fast food containers, wrappers, microwave popcorn bags, pizza boxes, and candy wrappers might have a certain level of these in them. So they're just so widely used. What about household products? What about household dust that you might be breathing in? Stain and water repellent used on carpets, upholstery, clothing, and other fabrics, cleaning products, nonstick cookware I mentioned before, paints, varnishes, sealants. What about personal care products? Shampoos, dental floss, cosmetics might contain PFAS, and that's news to me about dental floss. A fertilizer from wastewater treatment plants that doesn't really treat them out. So you're seeing that there's a tremendous amount of sources of this. So what I'd like to do is steer you to a website, and this is an interactive map you can go to, so you can get some ideas. You know, you're not going to necessarily get what's in your backyard, but you can see some of the sources in your areas. And the map has been recently updated as far as March of this year. And this website is ewg.org. I would Google PFAS interactive map, and this should take you to this website. So there is a map right on that website, the main page of the website, and you can go in and see what is happening, at least the kind of levels around you. And you will basically pull up a map of the United States, and there's different dots on this map. And these dots are color-coded for drinking water supply, military sites, and other sites. So you can check on these various types of sources of the PFAS level. Between 2016 and 2022, basically the EPA has been working off of what they call an advisory health limit. And this is not like a set hard limit, but this is basically an advisory. We're still trying to figure out what levels are an issue to us as far as humans go, or wildlife, or critters in our food supply. And what they're saying is 70 parts per trillion for PFOS and PFA. So what they're saying is the advised health limit is 70 parts per trillion. So if you are above 70 parts per trillion, you're above the advisory limit. If you're below that, you might be in the safe zone. Although we don't fully know what issues can help or happen at those lower limits. So back to the map, and this, what you can do with this interactive map is you can click on these dots. So I live in the Denver area of Colorado, and if I click on a dot near me, it lists all of the different chemicals that basically make up the total of PFAS. So I'm looking right now at a site kind of in the Denver area, and this is a drinking water system I'm looking at, and basically it's saying total PFAS is 64, so that's below the limit. That's kind of in the west side of the Denver area. Now you can zoom in on this map, and that's what I'm going to do, just to give you an example. If I head towards, let's say, a military base, we're looking at, let's say on the east side of Denver, we do have a military base, and it's been a military base for a long time. It was originally a Naval Air Station, turned to an Air Force base, turned to an Air National Guard base, and now it's a combined Air National Guard base and U.S. Space Force base. That's basically the Buckley U.S. Space Force base. And if you look at the groundwater on base and you look at all of the different chemicals, every one of these components is above that limit. So you're looking at, in the groundwater, 72 plus 90 plus 4, 75 plus 36, 30, 344, 341, 685. That's adds up to well above the limit. So that's a former military base, or actually an active military base. If I go to the Pacific Northwest, where I was in the area near the Naval Base Kitsap or Bangor, actually they're a little lower than I expected, but private wells off of the base are showing 178. So a little more than twice the limit. Now, if I go south of where I live towards Colorado Springs, and we have several military bases in the Springs, Fort Carson, we have the Peterson Air Force Base, we have Cheyenne Mountain, and right now I'm looking at Shriver Air Force Base, which is just east of the city, and there it's showing about 870,000. So it's interesting to click on the military sites in an area. If we look at some of the sites that are listed as other, this is one up in the mountains, just west of me. The contamination site is called the Sugarloaf Fire Department 192 in Sugarloaf, Colorado. They're looking at about almost 1,300, well above the limit. And a lot of industrial sites, you will probably find the PFAS could be extremely high, into hundreds of thousands. So it's really all over. And this map can give you an indication of what might be around you. Let's say you live in Nebraska. Let's say you live in Grand Island, Nebraska. And I'm just going to click on that site. And it's well below the limit. So that's a good one. Let's look at Wichita, Kansas. Okay, 39,000. Oh, 471,000 would be the total. So this would be McConnell Air Force Base. So that's a military site. So we do have these chemicals all over. So I guess the question is, these have been persistent a long time, you know, basically since World War II, 50 years plus. And think of the products that you might use in your home. Teflon, we've mentioned, 3M, Scotchgard, etc. So it's something that hopefully this podcast, if you haven't been aware of it already, will give you an indication of some of the issues associated with this. And I guess the question is, what do we do about it? Well, one of the things we can consider doing is looking at some treatment options. So PFAS do dissolve in water, and they mean the traditional drinking water treatment technologies that we've had for a long time, primary, secondary treatment, the standard treatment, and a lot of tertiary treatment may not be able to remove them. So there's a lot of research going on about looking at how can we better remove PFAS. And there are some solutions that are already out there. We can use activated carbon as one of the most studied processes for removal. Activated carbon is commonly used to absorb natural organic compounds, taste and odor issues, synthetic organic compounds, etc. We've also looked at some filtering. So essentially, PFAS can be removed to a good extent from drinking water when it is flowing through various filters, and those are being experimented with all the time. So we have some options, but maybe one of the better options is also to look at the source. What can we use in exchange for treating it on our end of the system? What can we do to maybe reduce the use of these types of chemicals? Because they're so valuable in a lot of products, they're probably going to be out there for quite a long time. So before I do get into this, you know, I mentioned that we could be doing better treatment processes such as filters. Problem is, these are high maintenance. They're going to cost to put in, And also they can occasionally clog, and or over time, if they're not maintained, their ability or their effectiveness in removing forever chemicals can be compromised. So it's a constant maintenance situation. So ingestion from food or being exposed on a constant basis, such as in the working area, what we need to do is looking at trying to eliminate some of the exposure. And maybe we can look at other types of chemicals to replace PFAS with. But again, the question is, what is safe? And any new product that comes out, oftentimes we think it's safe, like we did with Teflon for a long, long time. Maybe we'll try something else, and or in the long term we find that there are issues. That's one of the problems with trying to decipher a lot of these issues. So one thing we can do, at least at maybe eliminating the source, is a voluntary phase out of certain PFAS chemicals used in various products. So 3M was the principal worldwide manufacturer of these chemicals, about 80 to 90% of global production, and they would be a good source to look at possible alternatives. They've been trying to phase out some of these chemicals, but that's still something that's going to require a lot more research. So understanding what we could do as far as finding alternatives to these types of chemicals that are effective and what they're meant to do. For example, non-stick cooking, there might be other chemicals that can be used. Those would at least reduce some of the source rates. But we also have to be sure we look at reducing the impact of PFAS to us as far as getting into our bodies on our sources of food, the types of food that we use, etc. And of course, the types of products. It's really hard to get away from these things. It's a conundrum because they're so widely used and we're so well exposed to these things that, you know, a combination of reducing the source, maybe looking at alternatives, and potentially looking at how we can best prevent us from being exposed so much, or exposure risk reducing that. And that is going to probably take some time. So it's quite a problem. And of course, here I'm just in, say, 20 minutes or so, I'm just touching the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more to learn about these. There's so much to learn about what products that they're used in, how we can be exposed to them. That could be in our clothing. Could they be, for example, in a surgical mask? All those types of things that I don't think we fully understand, at least the average person like me doesn't fully understand. And it's hard to comprehend how can we change all of this. So they're probably going to be around for a while, still used in production, but maybe we have to somehow have some type of warning labels or something that a certain product contains these, and we can maybe make decisions on our own. So there's a lot to unpack, and I'm just going to leave it at that right now. Hopefully I've given you a little information that you can think of, and we'll probably be talking about PFAS in the future as part of water quality problems that are still hard to treat for and hard to eliminate from society at this point in time. Okay, so I am going to conclude. We're at the 30-minute mark here. I appreciate you joining us. Now, as I mentioned before, I'll probably be taking the occasional week off this summer. I expect that I will be back next week and maybe take the week off. I'm meeting with my co-host this week. Hopefully we'll get together and I will bring him in maybe in our next episode to get things rolling with Mr. Tom Check, a person that's going to add a lot of diversity, a lot of balance. So I appreciate you joining me in this episode. We will be back next time with another topic to talk about in the water resources arena. Thanks for joining us. See you again.